Good morning and welcome, welcome, welcome to the West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, affectionately also known as WUF. I'm Salima Malson. I'm going to try this without my glasses. I'm Salima Malson, and my pronouns are she and her. And it is my joy and my privilege to welcome you this morning and to help guide this service. So when we say welcome, we mean welcome to everybody. Everyone, whether you are here in the sanctuary or at home watching on your favorite screen, regardless of where you're from, where you've been, or where you're going, or whom you love, and whether you've been coming to church all your life, or you're just now starting to dip your toe in the water of religious community, we just are so glad to have you with us. I'm reminded of the words of the author Alice Walker, who said, "Love is not concerned with whom you pray or where you spent the night when you ran away from home. Love is concerned that the beating of your heart should kill no one." So let's begin this morning by standing together in body or spirit and singing hymn number 347 in your gray hymnal, "Gather the Spirit." And Gail's going to lead us in song.
Gather the Spirit, harvest of power, our supreme fires will kindle one flame. Witness the mystery of His hour, our trials in life appear all the same.
Good morning. I am Alana. I use she and her, and I am delighted to be aiding in the service today. I invite Nora, I believe, to come forward to light our chalice, And I encourage you to consider with me for a moment what this symbol, the chalice, means as an emblem of our community and our connection, our shared goals, our collective toil, but most of all, our communal hope. Thank you, Nora. Oh, and then we open with our affirmation as well. And I didn't write that down. Thank you. Please share with us in reading our affirmation together as a community. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful and what is wondrous. Let us open our minds to learn what is true and what is mysterious. Let us open our hearts to love ourselves and our neighbors. Thank you. And we encourage you to, I think I'm supposed to sit down.
We are having fun this morning, and that is, and we're welcoming, let's welcome Alana. She is one of our new lay leaders. Yes, yes. So, here we are. And our service this morning is focused on what it means to believe and how what we believe shapes and informs our daily lives. It will be indeed our joy and delight to hear from Wade and Martha McJacobs. They are newish to WOOF, but bless their hearts, they have been best friends for 40 years. Married for 38. Now, one growing up as a dyed-in-the-wool Unitarian, and the other a Buddhist from young adulthood. How does that kind of marriage work? We'll hear more about that later. So with that in mind, let us share a responsive reading titled It Matters What We Believe. The words are on the screen. Yours are in italics. I'm sorry? It's number 657 in the gray hymnal. So I'll give you a minute to just find that. All right. I'll tell you what, for those of you that don't have a hymnal, I will read your words and you can repeat them after me. How's that? Okay. Some beliefs are like walled gardens. They encourage exclusiveness and the feeling of being especially privileged. Your lines are expansive and lead the way into wider and deeper sympathies. Some beliefs are like shadows, clouding the children's days with fears of unknown calamities. Other beliefs are like sunshine, blessing children with the warmth of happiness. Some beliefs are divisive, separating the saved from the unsaved, friends from the enemies. Some beliefs are bonds in a world community where sincere differences beautify the pattern. Some beliefs are like blinders, shutting off the power to choose one's own direction. Other beliefs are like gateways, opening wide vistas for exploration. Some beliefs weaken a person's selfhood. They blight the growth of resourcefulness. Other beliefs nurture self-confidence and enrich the feeling of personal growth. Some beliefs are rigid, like the body of death, impotent in a changing world. Other beliefs are pliable, like the young sapling, ever growing. Now we'll turn this back over to Alana.
We take the time to consider that we are grateful, what we are grateful for as individuals and as our community, because we are, as woofers, very lucky, blessed, whatever you consider that to be walking among trees that we did not plant, to be gathering in community in a sanctuary we did not build. And so we spend this time considering all the things that we can do now as a community to work together toward continuing to blossom, because we rely heavily now on the dedication of those who came before us, and now we consider the gifts that we have to share with each other as we continue to blossom as a community. So as the hosts prepare to gratefully receive our offering today, please consider what you might have to share with your community as we continue to grow and commune. Please join us in our affirmation of giving. Let us be grateful for what we are able to give, for many do not have that privilege. And let us be grateful for those who share the gifts with us, for we are enriched by their giving. And let us be grateful even for our needs, so that we may learn from the generosity of others. And now I will welcome the kids up, because it's your time. And I will ask all the kids to come up and pick out some markers for us, because you are going to help me illustrate a concept for the adults. If the new youth council has taught me anything, it is that we need to listen to the kids' words a little bit more. So here, oh, thank you, Irene. Are you helping us? Thank you, sweetie. Right there for me, please. We're having the kids come up and draw us a picture together of what connectedness and community feels like for them. And I went and gathered some of their words for you adults to meditate on, to think about what their version of community is and what community we are building for them. So I'll share those words with you while they draw this beautiful depiction of what they see as their community. Starting with, the words I gave them as their prompts were connectedness and togetherness. So Ada said, good relationships and being helpful. Oliver said, helping someone out and being a friend. Hazel said, I feel warmth inside. Gil said, people talking to each other. Eleonora said, you. Paisley said, friends spending time together. Kel said, kindness and friendship. Nora said, everyone being together and being friends and loving. Irene said, zippers, because they come together. Like, think about it. So smart. Avery said, holding hands. And as we consider these concepts, I hope that we all take to heart the lesson that the children have so much to teach us, and we can learn so much from their concepts of the things that we think we know a lot about. We talk about every day, and they internalize, but they internalize in their own beautiful way through their own childlike lens, and they spit back out to us something so much more pure than we ourselves could build. This beautiful piece of art is going to be displayed out in the foyer outside for you to also meditate on and consider. Yes, of course, I'd love to read the words again. Ada said, good relationships and being helpful. Oliver, helping someone out and being a friend. Hazel, I feel warmth inside. Gil, talking to each other. Eleonora, you. Paisley, friends spending time together. Kel, kindness and friendship. Nora, everyone being together and being friends and loving. Irene, zippers. Avery, holding hands. All right. They could probably do this for a lot longer. So, kids, thank you so much. If you want to cap your markers, we're going to sing you out singing This Little Light of Mine with enthusiasm and joy as we sing them out.
It is nice to see our kids up here doing what they love doing. And so be sure and look at the artwork in the foyer when you leave. Some say that it is poetry that helps us balance the beauty and the brokenness of this incredible world that we live in. Each week during our time together, we take a few minutes to consider the joys and sorrows of ourselves and of others, those we know and love and those not so much. In her poem, The Thing Is, Ellen Bass reminds us to love life, to love it even when you have no stomach for it. She goes on to say, and when you have asked yourself, how can a body withstand this? She says, hold life like a face between your palms. A plain face, no charming smile, no violet eyes. And say, yes, I will take you I will love you again. So if you have a joy or a sorrow on your heart this morning, a celebration or a sadness that you would like to give attention to, I invite you now to come forward and either silently or with a few words, place it into a stone and let it go into the water that symbolizes the love and support of this community. Betsy will play some music for us and we'll come up this aisle across and back. I'll bring the microphone down. I think. Friend Sharon Fursett, who's here today. And this beautiful white stone is for my friend Caroline, who passed away yesterday.
For a friend who is getting some news about a possible heart condition next week, just hoping he'll be able to do what he wants to do the rest of his life.
This stone for my friend who's going through yet another day treatment for cancer.
Celebration of the birth of my son. I just want to share that my dad's funeral was amazing and that he would have loved it.
Probably did. And one last stone for all the joys and sorrows that remain in the silence of our heart, and for all those around the world suffering. So, Let us settle in now just a little deeper for a few more minutes of quiet time for reflection, meditation, or prayer as you may wish, accompanied by Kara and her cello. Our second reading this morning is from The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. Then Elemetra spoke again and said, "And what of marriage, Master?" And he answered, saying, "You were born together, and together you shall be forevermore. You shall be together when the white wings of death scatter your days. Aye, you shall be together even in the silent memory of God. But let there be spaces in your togetherness, and let the winds of the heavens dance between you. Love one another, but make not a bond of love. Let it rather be a moving sea between the shores of your souls. Fill each other's cup, but drink not from one cup. Give one another of your bread, but eat not from the same loaf. Sing and dance together and be joyous, but let each one of you be alone. Even as the strings of a lute are alone, though they quiver with the same music. Give your hearts, but not into each other's keeping. For only the hand of life can contain your hearts. And stand together, yet not too near together. For the pillars of the temple stand apart, and the oak tree and the cypress grow not in each other's shadow." Welcome, Wade and Martha McJacobs.
Am I on?
Yep.
Are you on?
Am I on?
I'm putting my watch here because I have a tendency to talk too much. Keep me on track. You can tell because she only has one card of notes. Go ahead.
Thank you for welcoming us so warmly into this community. So where did I come from? I grew up in a family where we were Episcopalian, and it was one thing I shared very deeply with my father. We went to service all through the year. And then I left home, and I let go of the Episcopalian church, and I moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts. I started Transcendental Meditation. Then I moved to Bangor, Maine, of all places, and I was in training to become a crisis counselor for women who were experiencing domestic abuse. In the training, I was introduced to a woman who said, "Hi, my name is Bayard, and I'm a Buddhist." And my whole being just, I don't know, it just opened. A couple of days later, I sat down on a cushion in her shrine room, and I felt like I had come home, like I'd never come home before. So I've been practicing Buddhism for over 40 years, and then I met him.
Nice introduction. I grew up in a Unitarian church in Bloomington, Illinois, and the only time my dad ever attended was somehow Mom persuaded him to. He was a very good atheist, avoided religious thinking of any kind. But my mom was very engaged, and we went to Sunday school, did all the stuff that you do at that age, and we started a youth group. For some reason during that time frame, there was the youth groups in UU churches were struggling, and we just, the high school students wanted to do something, so we started one. And we did a lot of service work. So I was very involved in the church. And then I went to college. That was that for that. But I was a religion major, I think, somewhat in defiance of my father. But I was searching for a way to answer the question of why and how people come to believe things without evidence. So I was very science-oriented, very much in my head. And after college, I had an opportunity to travel in India with a friend of mine who was studying religious pilgrimage. And part of our routine was to visit this one temple. It happened to be a Hanuman temple, to study its daily rituals. And I was sitting in front of a shrine dedicated to Rama, and something happened. And I can't explain it. But I think it was probably a similar feeling that you had when you met Bayard and sat on the cushion. It was a moment of mystery and joy, but at the same time it was confusing. And there was excitement with that. I didn't know what to do with that. So I came back to Portland and started graduate school and met you.
And my starting graduate school, I had just come back from a 3-month Buddhist seminary where I was convinced I was going to join the nunnery. And why that thought came to mind, I don't know, but it was an incredible experience. 3 months of practice, study, and a lot of silence. And it was a mind-body experience.
spiritual change for me. And I flew back from the East Coast. I got off the plane, and I went, I'm home. You know how that feeling comes over you? You just know something is right. It's just, regardless of what's going on, it just feels right. So I had been a gypsy for many, many years here and there, and I thought, I've got to go back to graduate school where we met each other. And
it was Bob Jarvis's class on language development. September 1984.
That's right. he's our date guy, and we had to test each other on all these tests because we were going to become learning specialists, special ed teachers. So we were giving each other these tests that we had to give.
Yeah, we became study buddies.
Yes, we did.
But it was very interesting. I was sitting in the classroom. She came in, or she was sitting and I came in. I don't remember which, on the first day, but we were like on the opposite sides of the classroom. And then over the course of the next 2-4 weeks or so, we like... And by the time we got to the point where we were studying this, one of the IQ tests that are given to students, special ed students, we were sitting next to each other and we were studying the language of the IQ test, but I think we were studying each other. And she invited me to go on a date to a movie.
Yeah.
And I wasn't available, so I said, no, I couldn't do that. And then I said, how about a hike at some other date? And Eagle Creek in the Gorge was our first date. It was the beginning of what I only can describe as an adventure. I'm often asked how we could be together for so long. And I often, because of all the issues going on in my life, I often ask why she would want to be together with me for so long.
I had no issues in my life, wasn't it?
But I think we're past that point now. But the sense of adventure, I think, is what guided us. And the key thing about adventure is there's so much that's not known. And we went through all the trials and tribulations, which we'll tell you some of those in a moment. At every point along the way, it was just realizing that we don't know. There's so much we don't know. And I think our commitment to marriage was not to be something or even to do something in particular. It was just to accept the fact that we don't know together and just keep stepping out.
Yeah. So we got married. We decided and we planned our own wedding, and thus became another 8 years where we traveled. We were both teaching, so we had the same vacation times, and we took some really wonderful trips. And then we worked on communication. We were learning how to tell each other we were telling a joke, so we used the sign like this. This is a joke. This is a joke. Don't take it personally.
And we still use that sign.
We still do this. You know, you don't outgrow these things. We think that we all of a sudden become this enlightened being, but we don't. And I think what keeps us together for me is that we live with paradoxes all the time. Life is up and life is down, and there's always something to be learned or a lot of gratitude. So gratitude is every day we thank each other for what's happening for us, what isn't happening for us, and what we share and do with each other.
Yeah, the little stuff.
Yeah, the real little stuff.
She still thanks me when I make breakfast.
Yeah.
And I still thank her when she does the laundry. Well, we consciously made a decision to not have children in the first few years of our marriage, knowing that because of Martha's age, that we were risking not having our own children. And in fact, that's actually what ended up happening after several miscarriages. I had to come to accept the fact that I wasn't going to have our own children. And for me, this was really significant because I always thought I was going to have kids in my life. Always. Since I was 14, I knew I was going to have children. And I had to accept that. I chose to be with Martha. And I'll figure out how to bring kids into our life. And that was tough. But then...
then, on the same day, our very dear friend Martha and my sister-in-law, Rena, brought the same article out of the Oregonian from parents who just adopted daughters from China. And we just went, that's it. And that was in the end of May, the beginning of June. And by the end of July, we were signed, sealed, and delivered for knew we were going. And that's how we became parents. And it was a gift.
So that was end of summer, in the fall. And then we talked a lot about loving this child that doesn't exist yet. And we really worked on that idea of loving this child. And we didn't know who it was. We thought it was going to be a girl, because that's what you get from China. I mean, you get girls. In January, I think it was.
It was a rainy day. We were just getting home from work to go walk the dog. Kaya was our dog. And the phone rang, and we thought we better get it. Picked it up, and our fellow that was the part of the agency that we used, he said, "What color did you paint the nursery?" And I said, "A light green." And he said, "Oh, that's good." And then his wife, Nan, who's Chinese par excellence, said, "You have a son. You have a prince from China." And I said, "It's a boy?" I mean, totally. I had to do a whole talk about surprise and unknown. Total switch gears.
So we took about a half an hour drive to get to the adoption agency from our home, and we got in the car, and all we said to each other during that whole 25 minutes approximately was, "It's a boy. It's a boy. It's a boy. It's a boy." And by the time we got over there, he was ours.
Yeah.
And then we had still 5 months to wait. That was really hard.
I thought several times I was having a heart attack. So I thought, oh, is this what women who get pregnant go through? I thought, I bet they do. I mean, this is pretty intense stuff, right? So anyway, we finally traveled to China, had an amazing trip, came home with Devin. We decided on the name Devin, and we kept his Chinese name as his middle name. And then we thought, well, if we're going to get two kids, we've got to do it now. So we reapplied and started all over again. And Devin was 8 months when he came home, and Annie was 19 months when she came home. And Annie taught me two things in parenting. I mean, she taught me a lot more than that, but I loved picking out clothes for her. It's why I wanted a girl, right? And at 3, probably 4.5 or 5, I brought home the cutest dress ever, I thought. She said, "Mom, I'm not going to wear that." I said, "You're not?" And she said, "No, I'm not." I said, "Okay." So letting go. I learned how to let go of expectations with my kids at that time. And the other one was regrets. I kept thinking, oh, I wish I had been younger when I had my kids. And then I realized, if you were younger, you wouldn't have the kids you have today. So I learned a lot. about letting go and regrets. It was very helpful.
I had a different experience dressing Annie. There was a day where I got a call. Martha was off running errands. I got a call from the doctor saying, we can fit Annie in for her appointment in if you can get here in a half an hour. It's like,
I wasn't, oh, that's right. That's right.
And I'm at home alone with Devin and Annie. They're still in their pajamas. Okay. So I go into their room, pull up Devin, like, pair of pants, shirt, no problem. Then I open Annie's drawer and all these colors and flowers and polka dots and stripes came screaming up at me, and I immediately shut the door. I took a deep breath and I said, okay, choose something that's plain on either the bottom or the top. Open the door, pull out plain pants, then it didn't matter what the top was like. She was dressed. Letting go. We have so many stories of letting go. I'm going to tell a story about Devin in the crib.
Okay.
He was still in a crib. This is before Annie came along. I think he was 16 months old. And we're downstairs. His bed is upstairs. And we hear this thud. And we look at each other. It's like, oh, my gosh. And then we hear little footsteps cross the floor.
And then down the stairs,
he opens the door from the stairs and he goes, ta-da!
Well, time to give up the crib, right?
24 hours later, he did not have a crib anymore.
So now we're going to fast forward to retirement because our kids are, our son lives in Tokyo, our daughter lives in Burbank, California, and we made another shift. We made another choices of letting go. And all of a sudden, I used to be home. I gave up my work to be a full-time mom. And all of a sudden, I'm going to spend all my time with this guy over here that he would go off to work, and I could slowly get myself together, and I was doing some outside jobs. And all of a sudden, we're together 24/7. And that's what we learn. We learn how to be together through the ups and the downs and how to take our time, our what we need. And that's what we continue doing. It doesn't end.
We also learn to honor each other's tasks.
Yes.
And so Martha had delayed her career, and now she is quite engaged in her career teaching mindfulness classes. And we had to feed that. We had to feed what I do. I write and do it, teach. And we also have to feed each other's togetherness. So there's three entities when you get married. Not one and not two. There are three, and you have to feed all of them.
Yeah. And the saying that I live by as close as I can is from Sharon Salzberg. Be in awe of the burdens that people carry rather than in judgment and how they carry them. And I say that to myself because negative self-thoughts are alive and well. Even after 40 years of practice, they're still there. So that's sort of in a nutshell. And this is how we honor our children. We have our two favorite pictures that we put on our mugs as children, because they're not kids anymore.
Thank you so much. Stand up. She's saying to stand up.
Stand up.
I wanted to thank Karen.
Yes, Karen, thank
really
you.
Really moving.
Well, we are lucky. We have about 12 minutes that we can spend grilling them about what they didn't say, what we would have liked to have heard, or whatever. Just remember to be kind and in awe. So, Alana will pass the mic. If you put your hand up, if you have something you want to say, ask or comment about, and we'll get to you. I see Mike.
Mike is closer. Sorry, you're next.
I wondered if either of you had thoughts on Wade's childhood question about why people are so desperate to believe in things without evidence, as you put it.
I think, first of all, I would want to clarify the desperation part is secondary. It's a different thing. Because people believe things without desperation also. I had a teacher, a science teacher in college, who said that science can answer any question, but it cannot answer every question. And that distinction was really powerful for me to understand that. And that, combined with that, what I call a spiritual experience when I was in India, for me, I just keep coming back to that. Do you want to?
No, that's...
There we go.
Said.
Martha, could you please repeat that saying about be in awe?
Yeah.
I
want to
use that.
Okay. Stand in awe of the burdens that people carry rather than in judgment in how they carry them. You're welcome.
Thanks, you two. Fabulous presentation. I have a question of how you came to be here at WOOF and how you are finding it.
Well, I've been very active in aging with the Beaverton community. I've been on the Beaverton Committee on Aging, Viva Village, Age and Death Cafes. And the Buddhist group that I was engaged with fell apart. And they were getting very fixed that they thought they were the only group to be a part of. And I thought, that's not me. So Wade and I had a conversation. I said, you know, we're going to die one of these days. We plan on dying. And I thought, I don't have a community. So we had been to WOOF many, many years ago when we used to live right here in Garden Home. And it wasn't right for us at the time. So we said, let's go back. So we came, and we've been coming ever since. So it's been about 6 months.
More than that.
So time, date. He's much better at it than I am. And I feel welcomed. I feel part of a community that's just so rich, multi-generational, talking about aging and dying. It's really important, normalizing those realities that we live. So that's me.
I think also one of the things that keeps pulling me back is that I haven't got a sense from anyone here that they have an answer. Mm-hmm. And this community is involved in discovery and adventure and exploration, and no one is claiming that this is it,
yeah,
or someone, one belief or another. And that allows me to continue, that journey of trying to understand how we come to believe things without evidence. For me, that's important.
I have a question. I was wondering how each of your individual spiritual beliefs influenced the work you did with special education.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting question, Alana, because we taught in a public school. So I have to have a caveat. This was not special ed. I thought it was going to work for me, but it was not my passion. I did it. I went 12, 13 years. And then after that, I couldn't do it anymore. And that's, so what it taught me was that I had to say no. I had to leave it because it wasn't fulfilling me. And if I hadn't left it, we wouldn't have our children today. So it was, you know, there's that gift. that saying no to something so the door opened for something else to enter. So I'm not sure that I brought, other than kindness and respect to students, I'm not sure that I brought much of my Buddhist training or language into the classroom.
Thank you for staying home. My area of specialty was working with emotionally disturbed and abuse victims. And I did that for approximately 40 years. 31 of those was in public school teaching. And one of the most important aspects of working with abuse victims is to honor their path. You can't make them do stuff. Mostly I worked the latter part of my years teaching was middle school and high school. So the little ones I worked with a long time ago, but especially high school kids, you can't make them. And their experience is their experience, and it is filled with wisdom. And somehow you have to acknowledge their wisdom. And that's their starting place, and you grow from there. And sometimes it's ugly, the wisdom that they came from. But you have to honor it. And so my spiritual path was to make sure that I stayed grounded with myself so that I could hear their wisdom.
One more. Thank you for sharing. I know that in our family of origin, we tend to be influenced by our parents' own beliefs and what it is they share with us. So I am wondering what you shared with your children and if you would be able to share if they have followed any type of a spiritual or religious path.
Well, when we finally decided to adopt and the kids came into our household, I swore I was never going to be my mother. Good luck, right? And then I found myself talking just like her, and I went, OMG. So remember the quote, be in awe of the burdens that we carry rather than in judgment and how they carry them. And I went, oh, this is interesting. So I took it as an opportunity to look at the behaviors and the languaging that came from them. And that was my work. And when I found myself doing things that were really inappropriate or not helpful, I would take my kids aside and say, you know, what I said was not really the best thing to be said. And I started this when they were really young. So spiritually, we always talked about the Buddhist Eightfold Path and right speech and all of that and compassion and empathy and helping them be independent and living. Their choices were their, in fact, we gave our kids choices all the way along and then helped them live with the consequences of their choices when they were really small. So they had that practice. So when they became adults, all of a sudden, you know what to do now. So I'm not so sure it was so spiritual. I mean, we did go to church and on and off. But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, we talked a lot about them being alert to what they were feeling.
Yes.
And honoring their own paths and also that nothing was permanent. So if they had a thought, that was just their thought of that moment. And we spoke with them like that. But we let them have their independence. We often say we taught them to be independent, and damn it, they are. And but we never. I mean, an example of that is we have no idea what kind of grades they got in all through high school or college. We have no idea. We know that they got good enough grades to get the scholarships that they earned, but we didn't track their classes. That was their job. And we just honored the decisions that they made and tried to guide them through. But
I just made sure it was always at 3.5 because I knew that was the guideline for U of O. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We just,
that feels really good. Thank you so much, Martha and Wade. And as we end our time together, I'm asking Alana to extinguish the flame of our chalice, knowing full well that that flame remains within each of us as our own little light going out into the world this week. And we hold all that has happened here this morning in our hearts. So let's stand together and circle out and get ready to go downstairs for coffee and for group soup today. Hope you're hungry. Also, I believe that the social justice community is holding conversation in Forest Hall. So here we go. We'll sing ourselves out with Carry the Flame.